Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Minorities in Publishing podcast. This is Jen, and as you may already know, the podcast is available on iTunes and Google Play, as well as Tumblr. You can find the podcast on Twitter at Minorities in Pub and Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. And today's guest is doing big, big things. Author and filmmaker David Barclay Moore, his upcoming debut, The Stars Beneath Our Feet, is a Penguin and Random House book, and also it was a BEA Book Buzz for middle grade earlier this year, and he's going to be around the block for a bit this fall, so definitely look into this book, and he's a local author for us New York City people. Welcome, David. So happy to have you on, and so happy to hear about all the good things and good words and enthusiasm and the fantastic blurbs that your book has been getting.
Well, thank you so much. And thank you for having me on. I really appreciate you reaching out and making this happen.
Yeah. We met at New York Comic Con last year.
We sure did.
In New York City. And David mentioned that he had a book coming out. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then I was like, oh, wow, it's a serious book. So I was really happy to hear back from you, see your website and everything you've been doing, because it kind of flows into so much of what it means to be an artist and the drive that people have to go into the industry and make things happen for themselves. So I was really excited about this conversation and reading more about your background as a filmmaker and now a debut author. And I wonder if being called a debut author, does that feel kind of weird to you, considering how much you've done in film?
Since I've been around the block.
Yeah, and you've been writing. It's not as though you haven't been writing.
Are you calling me an old head? I am.
I'm wizened.
With a very old head. Debut author, no, that doesn't feel weird. I've published a couple of short stories and written and did film stuff and some other artsy stuff, but you know, with this being my first kind of fully developed literary work, it is a debut, you know.
And so yeah.
I'm just, you know, kind of happy to be at the party and feel very blessed because it's been a really great rollout thus far. And I'm, you know, looking forward to this fall.
Mm-hmm. So you're not from New York City. You're from Missouri. And you came to New York City.
Correct, yeah.
And you got your degrees in the arts, which not every artist does. Sometimes they just English majors and all that stuff. That doesn't necessarily mean you did creative writing. But you specifically went to school for the arts. You were from Missouri, and then you came to New York City, as per your bio says, with $500 in your pocket, which was amazing to me, because I said, wow, I don't even know how far that would stretch now, $500.
Exactly. Well, yeah, well, my mommy gave me that money, too. You know, God rest her soul. Yeah, I was born and raised in Missouri, just outside of St. Louis, not too far from Ferguson, Missouri. Mm-hmm. My best friend actually lives in Ferguson. You know, just kind of growing up, I mean, I was very fortunate to go to a really great elementary school that had really great arts classes and a great arts program, arts and music program, which nowadays it's not as common, unfortunately. I was exposed to the arts and music at a very early age and used to love to draw as a child, you know, a lot, and started drawing little comic strips, you know, and then started reading comic books. Mm-hmm. So I was like a huge geek growing up, reading comic books before they were cool and before they were in the movie theaters. Like every other week, some new variation of some superhero thing comes out. And you know, but then as a teenager, when I went to prep school, I kind of fell in love with the notion of moving to New York.
And why is that, do you think?
Well, you know, I came of age in the 80s, and it seemed like a lot of activity and excitement was circulating around New York City, particularly in kind of pop arts movement. Andy Warhol and Madonna and everyone else in between. And it just seemed like a very exciting, vibrant place. It also, I mean, there was a whole kind of crack epidemic going on in the 80s too, you know, which was could have been a little daunting, you know, as far as wanting to move here. Going back to being a teenager and adolescent, I knew that I always wanted to work in the arts, always wanted to be a writer and wanted to make movies particularly. And so I figured that New York or LA were the two best places for me to be. I mean, now, you know, the times are different, but back then, Yeah, New York and LA were definitely the two best places to be if you wanted to write and make it in publishing and or film. Mm-hmm. And I specifically chose New York because of the subways. You know,
accessibility,
the
beach, so to speak.
Yeah, and more importantly, really, is it just to me? It always seemed like a kind of a smarter place for the arts than say LA, particularly when it came to film. You know, I always used to joke with my friends saying that had I moved to LA right after college, as opposed to New York, I could have been making all kinds of money, like writing for Moesha or. some ridiculous
and the theme
sitcom.
Song popped into my head.
But you know, at the time, I didn't want to write for Moesha. You know, I wanted to write serious stuff and make it as a serious artist. You know, and now of course, as I get older, I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that Moesha money probably would have been really good. So yeah.
So also, I want to touch upon, that's a big move, Missouri to New York City. And I don't want to make it seem as though New York City is this kind of extraterrestrial land, no man's land that's just dangerous, because I understand what people outside of New York see of it to an extent. You know, this kind of cliche, dark and gritty, quote, the words most used about New York have been, it's dark and gritty, you know, things like that. And so coming to it, was there any hesitation at any point? Because it sounds like you were pretty adamant of, I need to go to either LA or New York. New York seems to be the place, you know, theater, the museums, and et cetera. And I wonder if having just $500 and coming from Missouri, there was any hesitation or any kind of fear, because I think a lot of people are afraid to make that leap, period, but also to pursue art.
Yeah. Well, I had been to New York several times before I moved here. I went to school up in Iowa, but I did visiting programs at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and also at a French university, l'Université de Montpellier. And so, yeah, I lived in France before I moved to New York, and I lived in Washington, D.C. for 3 years before I moved to New York. So when I lived in D.C., I would visit New York City for the art scene and hanging out in conferences and stuff like that. So I was very familiar with it. I had friends here.
Oh, cool. Okay. So it wasn't this abstract place for you.
No,
like
no,
you actually knew what to expect, so to speak.
Yeah. When I moved here, I had a place to stay for about 3 months, 122nd and Morningside.
Right? Not too far from where we are.
Exactly. Because within Harlem or spitting distance of Harlem, depending upon how you look at Morningside Heights, right? $500 in my pocket given to me by my mother. And one of the things, though, that I knew back then, I mean, you talk about being afraid of moving here to the big city, you know, it was exciting. But at the same time, I realized that I was very fortunate to have a safety net. Mm-hmm. Via my family.
As in you can go back at any time.
Yeah, I could go back. I didn't have a lot of money. I struggled when I first moved here. But at the same time, you know, I'm the youngest. I had three older siblings at the time who were all gainfully employed and had gone to college and stuff. And so I had the ability to reach out to them, even though I didn't like doing that because it would make me feel like I was failing, you know. And just, you know, in the back of my head, and also my parents, you know, it's like, you know, my bedroom to this day still looks the same as when I was an adolescent back in Missouri. You know, I own the home now, but it still looks the same. My parents kept it for the most part, you know. So I always knew that I could, if I fell flat on my face, I could go back. And a lot of people don't have that, you know, particularly if you come from like a lower economic level. So, you know, it was a struggle. It was very hard moving here and surviving and thriving eventually. But at the same time, I always had that fallback, I knew. So it made it easier than a lot of other people.
Because I've talked to some people about this idea of failure, of if you don't make it in New York and what does success mean to people, that they hesitate to leave because it seems to be an admission of failure. And I find that interesting. That's like, you're like, oh, well, I have the safety net and I was still able to make things happen for myself. And maybe it didn't happen overnight, you know, like debut author came down the line, but you were doing so many things to pursue your art? And did that, do you feel like that really helps sustain you to keep going?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I never at any point did I ever feel like I would fail. To this day, there's never been a point from when I was a child until now where I actually felt like I wouldn't succeed. That's just how I've always felt. You know, it's not like whatever, but and there also was, I think, a part of that where when I was much younger, I was very content to live a bohemian lifestyle. You know, and a lot of my friends would often tease me about that. Like when I lived in D.C., when mm-hmm. I was at Howard and places, and they would make jokes about mm-hmm. living a certain bohemian type of lifestyle. And for me, that was fine. I mean, mm-hmm. during that period, I didn't crave money. You mm-hmm. know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so money was not important to me. Mm-hmm. I just really wanted to create things that were substantial, mm-hmm. right? That was my main kind of concern. Mm-hmm. As I got older, you know, then and mm-hmm. as you get older, you start thinking about retirement. You're like, okay, well, I gotta start making some coins to make sure I can age gracefully.
Still have nice things.
But when you're young, at least I didn't really care about that. I was more, you know, I wanted to make great art.
Yeah. Well, I want to get to your book, The Stars Beneath Our Feet, which is a wonderful, wonderful book. And I feel like it's different as in terms of what we're seeing. Like there are certain things I feel like in terms of subject matter that we might see some crossover of, but it seemed like there was a very specific purpose with the story you were trying to tell. And I don't want to kind of input that on you and say, oh, so what was the purpose of, like, what is the deeper meaning of this book or anything like that? But going back to what you were saying, quote unquote, serious art, and I'm sure you've been involved in this discussion or have seen or heard this discussion that kid lit is not taken as serious art by people in literary field. Now you have a different readership in a way from perhaps what you were aiming for. Middle grade is very much like, oh, this is for this audience, even though there's crossover where adults read it and whatnot. And I'm wondering, now that you have your debut novel coming out, being where you're coming from and what you've written, your short fiction, your screenwriting, what have you learned about the differences in approach of content and execution when it comes to writing children's lit, what is categorized as children's lit?
Yeah, no, you're right. It's a different audience for me for the most part. You know, I wrote a YA short story, actually a black queer YA coming of age story, which has actually been published in Best Gay Stories 2017. Mm-hmm, this mm-hmm. in August of 2017, I have a short story in there. And that's a short story I wrote a while ago in Killen's Review, originally published it. Mm-hmm. And there are a few other things that I'd written that were like kind of in that age group. But for mm-hmm. the most part, you know, it was kind of an adult target audience. So this novel that I have coming out, you know, Stars Beneath Our Feet, which is out September 19th, is a different audience for me. You know, I did a lot of research. I'm a big researcher. Mm-hmm. There's a couple of things I didn't research as much as I would have liked to for the book. But I won't talk about that. Hopefully people won't catch it.
Now they might be looking for it.
Just one thing, really. One thing I did. Yeah, and so I like to kind of plot things out and think about things, and it's not just kind of a haphazard type of approach. But mm-hmm. yeah, I think one of the things that's different about middle grade literature is it, particularly from YA literature, mm-hmm. and an adult, is it, it a lot of the readers are coming from a very me-central perspective mm-hmm. in middle grade. Mm-hmm. And as we age and we enter into like the older kind of teens, and that our lives also expand, the different types of things that influence us, we grow into a larger world. And the middle grade, in my opinion, can be a little bit smaller, and it's more centered around the self and mm-hmm. kind of internal emotions and internal dialogues and, mm-hmm. you know, almost kind of graduating from that kind of selfish child type of thing to mm-hmm. like a more of a segue into adolescence.
That's one of the things. I haven't heard it usually described in that way. Usually it's they put these parameters in the description of there's kissing. There might be kissing in mid-grade.
Well, that too.
But there's, you know, there's no sex.
You know. That too. That
like, people just can't be mean in middle grade. There has to be a reason.
But those types of things aren't really important to me. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I mean, they are important in that I abide by them for the most part. Like the no sex, no curse words. Mm-hmm. Right? Even as far as extremely complex sentences, I try to stay away mm-hmm. from. I do use complex sentences, but not extremely, you know, mm-hmm. like Joycean, you know, things you want to stay away from. But other than that, I write the same as I would for an adult. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, but trying to keep in mind the things that we mentioned. And, you know, I enjoy it. I mean, I write lots of different types of things. I write adult stuff, nonfiction, screenplays. But the children's literature that I write, I really enjoy and I get a lot out of for lots of reasons. I think it's particularly for people of color, you know, we really mm-hmm. need, our kids really need to see or to hear their own voices mm-hmm. in
Especially
literature.
Especially in middle grade, there's been a... I mean, there's a dearth everywhere, but there's a big dearth in middle grade.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And for years, I lived and I worked in Harlem, and so I experienced like a lot of that firsthand, mm-hmm. as well as just being as a black man, you know. And so that's a large part of mm-hmm. writing the mm-hmm. type of middle grade youth-oriented material that I write mm-hmm. is addressing that kind of dearth, like you said, of material.
And do you think in terms of the consideration of kid lit, quote unquote, being lesser, where do you think this might even stem from? Because it's a consistent conversation and I'm really confused by like, where it's coming from. And I'm always intrigued by people who are kind of crossover artists who don't just do kid lit, like they might have found their way into kid lit by another avenue, or like you've been writing these voices, but maybe the style is different.
Well, I definitely do not feel that quote unquote kid lit is lesser than mm-hmm. adult literature. I think most of the issues and concerns and ideas that you can express in adult literature, you can also express in children's literature. You know, obviously there's a difference to it, but in my experience, it seems like a lot of the younger you get in literature, the more distilled the content becomes in kind of a poetic sense. Mm. You know, to the point that if you go all the way down to like picture books and storybooks, and it's like this really extreme distillation of kind of ideas and points, mm-hmm. and it's almost down to poetry right at that point. Mm-hmm. But a lot of picture books can be quite profound, you know, mm-hmm. just the way of like a haiku can be quite profound and say a lot in just a few words that can't be said in like several volumes, right? Mm-hmm. So I think in that respect, you know, it's the same thing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain rules that apply, but for the most part, it's the same mm-hmm. thing.
I think so. I would just like that to end, that kind of conversation to end.
But yeah, I haven't experienced that a mm-hmm. lot. So.
Really?
I guess I will. As I start moving around more. Because, you know, I'm pretty new to, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. you know, particularly the children's book world. Yeah. You know, yeah. So, yeah.
But I've seen, like, working in the industry, even for the podcast, I've seen, like, a clear divide. Not that to say people don't like either or. I read everything, poetry, kids lit, adult lit, blah, 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 genre. But I've seen it within the industry, like how certain publicists don't want to associate with certain, you know, when I was trying to do crossover events and being like, oh, I have some children's lit authors and some adult lit authors, if we're categorizing them in that way. And the publicist would be like, oh, well, that sounds children's lit heavy and that sounds not like our thing. And so it was very interesting to see, well, you're all talking about the same thing. So, but it was interesting to continually have to be aware of that. Anywho's, speaking of the stars beneath our feet, I really like talking to people about where the story began. Not just where people's careers started, but how the story began. And you incorporate a lot of things into this book. Yeah. Like middle grade tends to be quick reads, but that doesn't mean that they don't have a lot of impact, a lot of continuity and talking about a lot of things, but subtly in a lot of ways. So there's the ideas of gangs and turf wars, coming of age stories, expectations, disability. And I'm interested in all that, how all that got rolled together for Lolly's story of grief. Because I feel like the biggest thing that I hear about the book is it's about grief. But it seems like it's so much more than that, too. And I know the brother relationship is very important, and you noted that as well. So I wanted to ask about how all this gets woven together into this final product.
That's a good question. And I, for starters, I place a lot of value in imagination and creativity. Mm-hmm. You know that, and I think what people will find in The Stars Beneath Our Feet is a lot of it is my philosophy about creativity.
Mm-hmm. You mean how to engage it and how to foster creativity?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, there's a lot of different kind of notions and ideas and lines and within the text that kind of address that, and as well as the whole kind of narrative. You know, it does deal, I think, on with a lot of different issues, as you mm-hmm. mentioned. It kind of hopefully successfully kind of winds them all together into something that makes sense. Like, for instance, I mean, over the past 17 years, within my own family, we've had three deaths. Mm. You know, my mother passed away first, and then my brother, Brian, to whom this book is dedicated, he passed away. Mm. And then just last year, my father passed away. So, and I was very close to them, and actually was with all three of them, holding their hands as they literally passed away. Wow. You know, all of them kind of early in the morning, like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning in the hospital. You know? And so for me, dealing with the kind of death and grief that comes along with that has really been a large part of my life, unfortunately, for the past 7 or 8 years or whatever mm-hmm. it's been. And so, of course, I've thought a lot about it. In some ways, writing the book was kind of therapeutic for myself, mm-hmm. you know, and a lot of the kind of emotions that Lolly goes through in the story are kind of echo some of my own kind of emotions that mm-hmm. I was going through or dealing mm-hmm. with. And I guess in the same way that Lolly finds a way to kind of exercise his creativity and it eventually winds up kind of saving him, in some ways, this book was like that for me, in that it kind of alleviated some of the on my own grief, mm-hmm. you know, by my just kind of creating this thing, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of piece of work, right, out of my imagination. It was in a lot of ways, it was kind of me exercising my own kind of mm-hmm. grief.
Because mm-hmm. Then there's all these kind of pathways to grief. And I think it's really important to have books about grief, period, but especially for young readers, because I feel like that's not talked about enough, how people deal with grief, or they talk about the same four books over and over again.
Exactly.
And the pathways for him to deal with grief through the Legos, which isn't spoiling anything because that's on the cover. Yeah. But also the support he has and him trying to be support to other people. To his friend, who's his best friend in the neighborhood, who's also dealing with the same turf issues
and trying
to protect themselves, and also having people in the community center. And I like that seeing, I don't want to phrase it as positive and negative, but I liked seeing that Lolly had people. You know, that Lolly wasn't alone. And that was a comfort for me as a reader, of not like, oh, this destitute black child who has to work it all out themselves, because, you know, black children have to age themselves 10 years because of the way society is, which isn't to say that's not true, but I feel like it's different in that we actually get the family dynamic, and there's an extended family for Lolly too. So that's what I found refreshing about the book.
Thank you.
So I didn't know if that was planned. Because obviously you're saying it's therapeutic, but it's different. It's very different because of what comes up for Lolly, too, being in Harlem, having a working class background, having that dysfunction with his parents, where the mother is the primary caretaker and things happen in that regard. I won't go into them. And so how do those kind of pathways come up as a writer of, okay, I'm going to write a book about grief and then what? like you have the in, but you don't necessarily have the world.
You know, I'm not a huge fan of like instructive literature.
You mean kind of specifically plotted out literature when you mean say instructive or
something that's specifically designed to, you know, point people in a certain direction or show people the way or how to.
Okay. This is not a self-help book.
How to succeed. yeah, so that was not my intention, but I think in a lot of ways it can work as a self-help book for kids, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are certain things in there that were included, I guess, to be helpful as far as the whole kind of grieving process and the fact that we as Black people don't seek out mental health.
And that's touched upon too.
Mental health issues and whatnot. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is that I did want to kind of touch upon a lot of those different pathways, you know, that he uses, but just not make it seem so quite so heavy and so obvious, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it is a piece of literature. It's not something that's designed to be a manual.
Yeah. Or the instructing guide to Black people. Poor children. They like Legos.
Legos.
I love Legos. They're the best. Yeah, I think that was a great tool to use with Legos.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, the thing that interests me about them is them being used kind of the way Lolly in the story uses them in their just being kind of basic block units, right? Where you can create all these different things out of them, as opposed to there being some type of overall branding associated with it. It's like, you know, whatever.
Like, should I not say Legos for branding purposes? It's just like building blocks.
No. It's fine to say Legos. I actually got a nice note from Lego, actually.
Really?
Someone within there who had read it, and they thought that a lot of it was kind of on point as far as their philosophy of approaching their toys.
Oh, cool.
So that was nice too. But yeah, no, I mean, there's something about them where they can be, there's these little basic units that can be used to kind of become anything, you know, and kind of limit is your imagination. So, you know, that's what the main thing that I liked about them is that they can be almost anything.
So now that you're a debut, what's your experience been like? And what weren't you, well, were you prepared for anything? And what weren't you prepared for?
Well, my experience has been great. It's been very unusual.
Also, you're a lead title, yeah? So you get a lot of visibility by the publisher.
Yeah, it's been very unusual. It's not like, it hasn't been normal. I realize that, and I'm very thankful for that. It's been abnormal in a good way.
Yeah, okay.
As you said, my book was selected as a Buzz Book for Book Expo BEA, which was
tremendous. Yeah, and that's a big
deal.
That's huge. You're probably going to NCTE too, right?
I'm not sure because it's. I know I'm going to the Miami International Book Festival, which is at the same time, so I have to figure out what's going on with that. But I also went to ALA in Chicago, which was awesome, and they had these big, you know, billboards up for my book, which was cool. Kind of mind-blowing.
Yeah. Did you do like a tease? Did you do like librarian tease?
I did librarian speed dating.
Speed dating?
Several times. Yeah, throughout the day.
Did you do that at BEA too? Speed dating or
it's
no?
Kind of all blurring into one. Possibly, maybe.
At a conference. There were a lot of librarians.
I love the librarians. I always have loved librarians. They help me a lot with my research. You know, I do a lot of research and stuff. So yeah, LA and Chicago was amazing, and just meeting a lot of different great people from all over the country, and being able to share my own enthusiasm for my novel, you know, with them was great. I have Brooklyn Book Festival coming up the weekend before my book
Yeah, it's published. 16th, 17th. Are you going to be there Kids' Day, the 16th or the 17th, which is the full?
On the 17th.
Okay, so I'll probably see you.
I think 4 p.m., September 17th.
Oh, that's when my panel is.
Oh, really?
Dang.
They're working against us.
Put all the POCs on at the same time.
4 p.m. is yours?
Really? Mine was actually 4 p.m. I purposely asked for 4 p.m. because I said, I'm not a morning person. Can we get the afternoon?
Well, one thing about the Brooklyn Book Festival is I will be signing copies. Well, I'll be doing a reading and a discussion, mm-hmm. but I'll also be signing copies of my book 2 days or so before the book comes out.
Yeah.
So that'll be the first time
people
will be able to get a copy, the official finished copy of the book will be at the Brooklyn Book Festival. So, they're going to just make that available just for that one little event.
Yeah, it's 2 days. Yeah, we can do that. Publishing works magic. So that's going to be Borough Hall, September 17th. Sunday, September 17th. Was there anything you were, and maybe that's a kind of unfair question too, is can you be prepared for anything when it comes to your book being published?
I mean,
prepare to be unprepared.
Yeah. I guess there is a certain, I think I have a lot of soft skills just from being around such a long time that I developed.
Maybe you're not awkward around people. Because you were definitely not awkward at New York Comic Con last year.
There's that. A lot of people, I am an
Introvert,
yeah, mm-hmm. thank you. So I am an introvert, but I'm not shy. So mm-hmm. when my friends hear me call myself an introvert, they always laugh because they're like, oh, we see you run up on people all the time. Yeah, so I think that prepared me, and just kind of working in the film industry for a while and other art stuff. As far as thing that has been the most challenging for me to adapt to thus far has been kind of elements of time management because... I have been fortunate in that there's been a lot of activity around my book, right? So I've been dealing with my editor and a publisher and several publicists I have, lawyers and several agents I have now. And so dealing with all that, lots of other things, just all these different appearances and stuff like that. So I wasn't prepared as much to kind of make sure that I make time for writing, because a lot of the stuff outside of writing has been taking up a lot of time, right? Mm-hmm. And so there is this whole thing where when it comes right down to it, you have to write these books.
Exactly.
And
but you also have to talk about these books. Yeah.
And all the other meetings and all the other stuff around it, mm-hmm. you really have to make sure you budget that time. So that is something that I wasn't expecting that has popped up. So,
are you going to steadily try to make that time? Or do you think that time is going to be negotiable with the book actually coming out in the month as of this recording?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, the main thing is during the kind of quote-unquote off-season, making time, making sure that I get the writing in at that time. Because when the book comes out for about 3 months, it's a lot of running around and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But, I'm usually pretty good at writing. I carry my little iPad with me and I can have MS Word on it. And so I can write in an airport terminal if need be. Mm-hmm. But, scheduling just kind of in a much more kind of wider sense, I think, is something that is very crucial.
Yeah, because they're going to want more.
Yeah.
I'm sure your publishers this is great. When's the next book?
Exactly. I mean, contractually obligated, as they say.
It's coming. It's always curious to me of how the balance happens, because especially when you're trying to break in, maybe you did have the time, maybe you didn't, maybe it was easy to navigate. Okay, this is done. And then once you actually have to promo, how do people balance that? And can you say no? And it's different from a debut versus the Jackie Woodsons of the world. But it's still something it seems like you need to protect, no matter what level you're at, no matter how many books you've written. It seems like you always need to protect your writing time.
Yeah, and I could see it. I mean, now, like I said, I wasn't expecting it, but I could see it getting much more challenging. So like, that's why I'm saying, like, right now is when I kind of have to, you know, grab the bull by the horns and make sure, because it's, you know, it already before the book has even come out, it's very busy. So you know, over the foreseeable future, one can only imagine, you know, how you have to kind of make sure that all that is taken care of.
Yeah, I hope you still love talking about the book.
Oh, yeah, I do.
Yeah.
I do, yeah.
Have you been able to talk with kids about it as much? Or?
Not a whole lot during some signings I have, you know, like a book expo in ALA.
Yeah, yeah, because there are not as many kids there, but there are like...
Yeah, people bring their kids, and they're usually very shy. And,
yeah.
You know, I sign the book for them, and some of them have read it. But I'm looking forward to that. Like, I'll be at Tweens Read in I think October down in Houston.
Oh wow, okay.
So that'll be nice. In New York, I'll be at Powerhouse Books on 8th. They have like a middle grade readers group.
Oh, cool.
Gonna be, you know, all over. And it's actually, if people are interested in knowing where I'll be making appearances, everything's on a calendar page on my website.
Yeah, which it's is, very good and up to date. Not everyone keeps theirs up to date. No shade to other authors, I'm just saying.
Which is davidbarclaymore.com is my website. So I tried to keep it up to date, but you know, things are constantly being added, so
that's a good problem to have, as long as you can carve out your writing time.
Yeah, exactly.
So how many people reach you? You said your website is David Barclay Moore, so that's B-A-R-C-L-A-Y.
Correct.
And more like M-O-O-R-E.
Correct. It's Barclay, like the bank, or like the Barclay Center. Or the cigarette.
Easily navigatable to spell. And you're on Twitter. It seems like you're on all the social media.
I am. And all my social media stuff is D. Barclay Moore.
That's
so
good.
Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, it's all D and... Snapchat, which I never use.
Maybe you will once you talk more with the kid readers.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah, they can tell me how to operate it, because it's mystifying to me.
Yes, but it's scary. I was like, no, that's the one thing. It's too weird. Yeah. Too weird. They give you ears and snout now.
Yeah. Yeah, so, and Instagram is a lot of fun, though. You know, I like the images and stuff, so I'm on those things fairly regularly.
And are you doing a launch for the book? Is there going to be a New York City launch?
Yeah. We're doing one in Harlem on September 20th.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Cool. So I will keep you posted.
Awesome. Please do. I want to make sure to come out. And thank you so much for being on the podcast. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much. I really, really appreciate you helping spread the word. I'm very excited about The Stars Beneath Our Feet, and I hope to get it into as many children's hands as possible.
Yeah, and it's a great discussion guide, I think. I mean, again, it's not an instructional book, but I think in terms of what it could kind of promote in terms of discussion is really, really good, especially like love of art, appreciation of art, architecture. There's so many things you can take from it, have the kids read it, and then go around the city.
Yeah.
See if you can find some of the spots that Lolly went to. See if you can take pictures.
Exactly.
So I think, you know, it can promote a lot of activity and appreciation for the arts since it's being cut in schools.
There's a lot of, I mean, there's some queer characters in the in the novel, which are in the issues, queer issues, which are brought up, as well as just dealing with and encountering people on the spectrum.
With
autism. Yeah.
Yeah, working class. Being working class in New York is real.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
I like that it's not done with this heavy hand. And that's what I think is important when we have representative literature, is those who are writing within the community understanding certain things that the community deals with in terms of those kinds of representations and how they can be dealt with in a way that's probably not intentionally disrespectful, but kind of doesn't hesitate to hit the stereotypical. And I think that Stars Beneath Our Book Feet does not do that.
Oh, well, thank you.
How do people write these books? That'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
So Stars Beneath Our Feet comes out September 19th, and you will be at Brooklyn Book Fest on the 17th, signing copies that will be available early for those who want to get theirs that weekend. And there'll be a crap ton of people, so I'm sure you'll have
it. Yeah, I'm looking forward to Brooklyn Book Fest.
It's going to be good. Yeah. No rain. It happens rain or shine, but still, like, no rain is very good for us.
Yeah.
So thank you again, David, for being on the podcast. And thank you for listening. Once again, you can find the podcast on iTunes and Google Play, as well as Twitter at Minorities in Pub and Tumblr at minoritiesinpublishing.tumblr.com. See you next time.
Thanks, Jen.
No problem.